Welcome to today's program titled, Happiness is a Warm Blanket, the Stark Law COVID-19 Blanket Waivers. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by typing your question into the box located on your screen and press enter. I would like now to introduce our host for today's call, Mr. Robert Holmchick. You may begin.
Thank you. I am joined today by both Renee Howard and Darby Allen, who I work with closely. They are healthcare regulatory lawyers. We have all been in the mix responding to requests and from our clients on the COVID-19 as well as the regular matters over the last few weeks. But both Renee and Darby will be adding their perspectives to this topic. And finally, Jillian Murphy, who's a partner in our Employee Services Group. Jillian will be providing perspective of employment law as they apply to certain of the options that have been created by the blanket waivers. As may be obvious, we're going to focus on the blanket Stark Law waivers that were issued by CMS on March 30th. This is an advanced session. If you found your way to the webinar, we're going to assume that you're familiar with the basics of the Stark Law. And in the interest of time, we won't be repeating those basics here today. I think Stark is often a law of unintended consequences. It's ubiquitous. Federal statute that affects virtually every financial relationship between a physician and any entity that furnishes designated health services to Medicare beneficiaries. It's complex, it's technical, strict liability. When a financial relationship fails to fit within an exception, the physician can't refer to the entity, and the entity cannot bill Medicare for the services. All of this makes the Stark Law really very challenging under normal circumstances. So in the whirlwind of changes prompted by COVID-19 crisis, it's small wonder that many in the industry were quickly calling for waivers. To its credit, I think CMS recognized the need for greater flexibility in the Stark Law under these circumstances, and in a surprisingly short time period, the agency drafted and published the blanket Stark Law waivers. If you've heard me speak before, you probably know that I can be critical of CMS. Today, I want to acknowledge the hard work and responsiveness of the agency staff. The blanket waivers really are responsive to many of the industry's concerns, and the agency deserves to be complimented for its good work. We will have some comments and criticisms and note some what we consider to be foibles in the waivers as we go through this. That should not take away from the agency's good work. We may be requesting some clarifications, but I think we all should acknowledge the efforts that were made. So moving on to today's agenda, we'll start with an overview. Then Renee is going to be talking about COVID-19 purposes. Darby will jump in with termination record keeping. We'll move on to specific waivers, examples, what's not covered, and some employment issues. We're going to attempt to save time for questions at the end, and you please feel free to enter those on your screen. Starting with the blanket Stark Law waivers overview, CMS has the authority to issue the 1135 waivers for Stark Law during periods of national emergency. When President Trump made his emergency declaration, that triggered the agency's authority. Now, historically, CMS has only issued Stark Law waivers on a case-by-case basis. In the wake of Katrina, for example, CMS issued several waivers, but they were all individual waivers pursuant to individual requests. The blanket Stark Law waivers issued on March 30th are really unprecedented. The agency has never done anything like this before. So how big is the blanket? Well, the blanket waivers were issued on March 30th, but they were made retroactive to March 1st, 2020. They're national in scope. They cover remunerations solely related to COVID-19 purposes between a DHS entity and a physician or immediate family member of a physician. Renee will be talking about that a little bit later in more detail. They remain in effect during the COVID-19 national emergency, and at that point, the government will take your blanket away. So the waivers include 18 separate, or the policy, the statement, 18 separate waivers. All conditions of the waivers must be satisfied in order for them to be effective, but the waivers are automatic. You don't need to make an application, no mother may I, just fit within the four corners. Records relating to the provider's use of the waivers must be furnished to the secretary upon request. This is a point that people should be paying attention to at the outset. And the waivers will not apply if there's a determination of fraud or abuse. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Renee for discussion of purposes.
Thanks, Bob. So obviously the application of these waivers hinges on whether there's a defined COVID-19 purpose. And, you know, the CMS waivers are clear that they only are going to apply to those financial relationships and referrals that are, quote, related to the national emergency, that is the COVID-19 outbreak in the United States. Obviously, that's a somewhat amorphous standard, so CMS has attempted to provide a little more definition to that by giving six COVID-19 purposes. And in my view, they go from fairly narrow to quite broad, which is both helpful and I think, as we'll discuss later, could potentially be challenging in terms of opening up the floodgates for requests from physicians to enter into Stark Law waived agreements. So starting with the narrowest, the one COVID-19 purpose is the diagnosis or medically necessary treatment of COVID-19. For any individual, whether or not the individual is ultimately diagnosed with a confirmed case of COVID-19. A COVID-19 purpose is also securing services of physicians and other healthcare professionals to furnish medically necessary services in response to the COVID-19 outbreak. So there the operative language would be the response to the COVID-19 outbreak. Next, ensuring the ability of healthcare providers to address patient and community needs due to the COVID-19 outbreak. So here we have a bit broader of a purpose of patient and community needs and the language due to the COVID-19 outbreak, not just in response to. So in my opinion, fairly broad. And unfortunately, because we don't have the benefit of CMS's full like regulatory rulemaking preamble, we don't have that much more definition on what CMS means by due to the COVID-19 outbreak. In addition, a COVID-19 purpose includes expanding the capacity of healthcare providers to address patient and community needs, again, due to the COVID-19 outbreak, shifting the diagnosis and care of patients to appropriate alternative settings due to the COVID-19 outbreak. And finally, what I think is the broadest purpose, addressing medical practice or business interruption due to the COVID-19 outbreak to maintain the ability of medical care and related services for patients and the community. So again, we have a fairly broad collection of COVID-19 purposes that will be, you know, up to the entity to document, you know, the existence of one of these in order to support the wage arrangement. Now I'm going to turn it over to Darby for some details on term termination and record keeping.
Thanks, Renee. So I'm sure hearing the general breadth of the waivers and the extensive COVID-19 purposes under which you might fit an arrangement has everyone thinking, is this too good to be true? How long are the blankets going to be around? CMS has said that they expect the blanket waivers issued in the statement, all 18 of them, to end when the public health emergency ends, although they are reserving their right to narrow or terminate one or more of the waivers at an earlier time point. They have ensured providers that if they do narrow or terminate the waivers, they will do so prospectively to give folks time to figure out how they're going to handle the waiver going away. We're going to have a little bit of audience interaction here. I'm about to click over and start a poll. There's been a lot of discussion about the effect of the blanket waivers ending and whether an agreement or an amendment that you put in place to take advantage of the blanket waivers has to end when the waiver ends, or if there's some flexibility to handle that. So I'm going to send out a poll right now that should pop up on your screen. So we'd like you to answer yes or no to the following question. Do you agree that all arrangements and amendments that rely on the Stark Law blanket waivers must end on or before the precise date when the waivers expire? A couple slides from now, I'll be back in the mix and let you know what our audience consensus was. Know that the results are anonymous. We aren't tracking or reviewing how you answer. So thought we'd have a little bit of fun this morning. A couple of tips here with respect to dealing with the term and termination of the waivers. As you'll hear later in the presentation, CMS has not done away with the writing requirement. There's some flexibility about when arrangements need to be documented and the timeliness, but you will still need to paper most of these arrangements to meet the writing requirement. So we would recommend that you consider some creative drafting here to make sure you're in the best position to deal with the waivers going away. That could be precise change in law provisions that explicitly address the blanket waivers. It could also be some flexibility in your termination provisions that automatically reform the arrangement or terminate it as necessary in the future once the waivers go away. So turning now to record keeping, as Bob mentioned, it's very critical in the statement that CMS has told providers that it expects them to maintain records and provide them to the secretary upon request. So it's really important to document the COVID-19 purposes contemporaneously. Keep in mind that the entire applicability and ability to take advantage of the blanket waivers hinges upon the fact that you are furthering a COVID-19 purpose that Renee summarized for you earlier. And documentation of those purposes, so that in the event the secretary, CMS, comes back to ask in the future why you did something during this period, you've got it all ready and organized, ready to go. It's the best practice. As noted by CMS in the statement. We also have a couple of suggestions for keeping track of waivered arrangements in general. We know that you all are very taxed right now, and there's a lot coming at you with respect to dealing with COVID-19 on the operational side of the house. But to the extent you can spare it, we do think it's a good idea to designate a point person to handle all physician arrangement requests during this period. Not only will that help to ensure consistent assessment and documentation of COVID-19 purposes and give you some assurance that you are going to be protected by one of these blanket waivers, but it will also help the organization address waivered arrangements when the blanket gets pulled, and inevitably it will. Even if you have followed our suggestion to include good language in the agreement that automatically triggers some change to the arrangement upon the end of the waiver to bring it back into compliance with an existing Stark Law exception, there's still going to need to be some follow through on the part of the organization to make sure that those arrangements are being operationalized consistent with the exception. So if, for example, you have decided to allow physicians to pay reduced rent, we'll talk about that a little bit later in the presentation. Your contract can certainly, or the amendment that you enter into can certainly document that reduced rent is only applicable during the period that the waiver is in place. But you also want to make sure that your folks who are actually out there collecting rental payments revert to collecting the full amount of rent at the applicable time. So having one single point person in charge of making sure that arrangements are appropriately reviewed at the end of the period and any changes made is an important compliance point. So now I'm going to send it back to Renee to talk a little bit about employment and personal services under the waivers.
Thanks, Darby. So jumping now to the specific waivers, the first one I think is an important waiver that everyone is glad to see. It's for employment and personal services arrangement. And this waiver allows payments to physicians by an entity that are above or below fair market value for services personally performed by the physician. So this, for example, would allow payment of, you know, additional compensation to physicians to, you know, compensate them for what's basically hazard pay, or restructuring procedure-based compensation methodologies, for example, to account for the fact that proceduralists are not able to provide elective surgeries for a given period of time. So certainly a very useful exception. It will likely open some floodgates of physicians wanting to revise their arrangements, you know, particularly if they're on a productivity methodology. So that will require some discernment of the circumstances under which these waivers will be given. It probably will not be feasible for organizations to offer waivers for all physicians, you know, who are paid on an RVU basis, for example. So there'll have to be some sort of thoughtful consideration to the circumstances under which waivers will be provided, and ensuring that decisions are made in a way that doesn't relate to volume or value of referrals by the requesting physicians. So in addition to those kind of big picture considerations, we also want to point out that tax-exempt organizations need to also consider issues with the, you know, the tax issues that come into play when there's arrangements that are not fair market value. So, to the extent that the organization wants to grant one of these or enter into one of these arrangements pursuant to this waiver, TEO issues should not be overlooked. And also, the anti-kickback statute should be considered. However, the good news there is that on April 3rd, the OIG issued a policy statement in which it announced that it is not going to be imposing any administrative sanctions under the kickback statute for the vast majority of arrangements that fit within the blanket Stark Law waivers. So that should provide some comfort to organizations that if they are entering into a compliant arrangement under the Stark Law blanket waivers, it should not have anti-kickback statute risk associated with that. I'm going to turn it now to Jillian, who has some employment and contractual related insights.
Thanks, Renee. Yes, this is your friendly neighborhood employment lawyer just popping in for a moment to remind everybody that these waivers do not equal a waiver of all of your employment obligations with regard to your providers. If you've got contractual obligations to those folks, you still have contractual obligations to those folks, even though these waivers have been introduced. So you're going to need to think hard and review those contracts and figure out if you want to take advantage of some of this flexibility with regard to compensation, for example. You're going to need to look at those contracts and make sure you do so appropriately. So I'll talk to you in a little bit later in the program, but back to Darby to hit us with a few more details about these waivers.
Thanks, Jillian. So before we jump into the rental exception waivers, I want to report back on our poll here. It looks like we've got some good audience participation, and actually the agree and disagree answers are running neck and neck. So 49% of you agree that all arrangements and amendments that rely on the Stark Law blanket waivers must end on or before the precise date when the waivers expire, where 51% of you disagree with that statement. And I'll give you a little bit of a preview. We'll address some specific examples as we move through the presentation here. But as I wouldn't be a licensed lawyer if I didn't say it depends. In my view, the arrangement itself does not necessarily have to come to an end. But as I said, once the blanket waiver is pulled, then we would need to make sure that there is a Stark Law exception that applies. So Bob's going to have some examples in the context of loans that I think are particularly relevant to illustrating how arrangements need to be revised at the end of the waiver period to make sure that you're still in compliance with the Stark Law. So back to the slides here. With respect to office space and equipment rentals, there's been some discussion out in the legal press around whether CMS did right by a number of issues where they specifically decided to protect arrangements with below fair market value compensation only and not above. And the office space and equipment rental points in the blanket waivers illustrate that. So CMS has extended waiver protection here for rental charges paid to a physician for lease of space or equipment below fair market value. And they've given us a couple of examples here that probably come from questions they received before publishing the blanket waivers. One where a hospital would use MOB space occupied by independent physicians for surge capacity of COVID-19 patients, and the hospital would pay below fair market rent during that period. Another example where a hospital would use off-campus office space of an independent physician for non-COVID-19 patients to make sure that folks are appropriately segregated from risk of contracting COVID-19 where possible. So these are two scenarios where the rental charges paid to the physician may be below fair market value, whereas the typical exceptions require all the compensation, the rental charges to be consistent with fair market value. And then in reverse, CMS is also protecting rental charges paid by a physician for lease of space or equipment at a rate that is below fair market value. So a couple of examples in this landscape, hospital allowing independent physicians to use office space located on the campus to assess potential COVID-19 patients and paying less than fair market, or a practical one that we're seeing play out, a hospital reducing or abating rent during the public health emergency. As we all know, hospitals, as well as other providers, and certainly physicians and independent practice, are all facing serious cash flow issues. And the idea that folks can continue to just pay rent to their, physicians can continue to pay rent to their hospital landlords like nothing has changed is probably a bit of a stretch. And so CMS is recognizing here that there needs to be some flexibility with respect to these rental arrangements to allow folks to, at least during the period the blankets are in place, pay or accept less than fair market value. I will say that a tip here is to try to determine the long-term plan for arrangements at the time you invoke the waiver. Back to our previous discussion, the more information you can have in your amendment or, the writing documenting how you're addressing these arrangements during the waiver period, the better off you'll be. And so including in there the plan for whether there's catch-up rent or the like in the documented amendment to the lease would be a good idea now. And similar to what Renee already told you with respect to services arrangements, we will caution you that there could be some tax exempt issues with respect to below fair market value charges. Our tax exempt colleagues have been really wonderful in helping us navigate some of these issues and given us some comfort on that side, but we would absolutely recommend that for you tax exempt organizations out there that you consider those potential tax exempt issues above and beyond the Stark blanket waivers.
And thanks, Darby.
We're back to Renee.
Yes. So the next specific waiver we're discussing is purchased items or services. So this particular waiver allows for below fair market value payments for items and services purchased by an entity from a physician. And also vice versa, it allows for below fair market value purchases of items and services by a physician from the entity. So notice here, though, the waiver is limited to below fair market value payments. It's not a above or below scenario. And we were, before this webinar, we're discussing, well, why did CMS only allow waiver for below fair market value arrangements in this instance? We don't have the benefit of any sort of rulemaking commentary to understand their thought process here, but our best guess at this is that the intention was to allow for, or basically to facilitate arrangements where, for example, a organization wants to purchase a supply of PPE or some sort of supplies that maybe a physician group has that's sitting there unused in a closet and would be beneficial to a hospital. And obviously it would be a good thing to allow the hospital to either, get those items for free or at some sort of reduced rate. So this
waiver would allow for those types of arrangements below fair market value. And, you know, providers would then not have to be concerned that entering into those good purchase or beneficial purchase arrangements would somehow violate the Stark Law. I'm guessing what CMS wanted to avoid was a scenario where an organization was paying above fair market value for these supplies. And, you know, you can envision, you know, some individuals exploiting the crisis and charging exorbitant prices for these types of items and services, and perhaps organizations being willing to pay those prices, you know, simply to get the items and services. So this particular waiver, I think, is designed to allow those beneficial arrangements and facilitate, you know, really appropriate transactions between providers. So again, you know, as we mentioned before, with any fair market value, any below fair market value payments, you know, consider TEO issues. And also, if the only issue in the arrangement is fair market value, you may want to think about whether or not this is even something that needs a waiver. You know, it could be that the fair market value of an item or service is simply changed in light of the COVID-19 crisis. So, you know, think about whether this is something that you even need a waiver for, or whether the value of the underlying services or items has actually changed. And now to loans.
Yes. One of the specific waivers that I was maybe a little surprised to see, but certainly welcome, permits loans to a physician or physician group at an interest rate below fair market value, or on terms that are unavailable from a disinterested lender. Essentially, kind of in this context, while not explicitly saying so, waiving the commercial reasonableness requirements. So an example would be a hospital loaning money to an anesthesia group, which has an exclusive contract to cover the physician's lost income due to the cancellation of elective surgeries, to ensure that the hospital has anesthesia services that it needs for COVID-19 patients. That is actually one of the examples, the official examples given in the formal publication by CMS. So the blanket waivers also permit loans the other direction. And the example given there is a physician owner of a hospital can loan money to the hospital to cover staffing expenses during the COVID-19 surge. Doesn't have to be fair market value, doesn't have to be commercially reasonable. So getting to the point of, you know, a hospital decides it's going to make a below fair market value loan to a physician group during the blanket waiver period because the group, you know, is going to shut its doors, they're going to lose providers in the community. You know, there might be a hundred different reasons why, but the waiver ends. What do you do? Do you have to demand immediate repayment the date that the waiver expires? That just seems silly to me. You cannot expect a group that is having financial difficulties to, on a dime, have the cash flow to immediately repay the loan you extended to keep it in the community during the COVID-19 crisis. So I don't think that CMS intended that this blanket, by issuing the blanket waiver, that you could only extend the credit for the period of the national emergency. I think rather that the portion of that arrangement, the below fair market value interest, that should change on the date when the waivers expire. And here, again, it comes to careful drafting, as Darby was mentioning earlier, anticipating this in advance. On the year, let's say you're at a 2% interest rate. On the date that the COVID-19 emergency ends and the waiver disappears, the amount of the interest should automatically reset, and you probably pick prime plus something, or, you know, some other commercially reasonable rate that is specifically tagged. Whether or not you want to recapture that interest that you weren't charging or the low interest, that I think is as much a business call as a regulatory call. From an exempt organization issue, those issues are still, you know, if you're an exempt entity making a loan to a private physician, you need to consider that. And I think the more you do to protect the charitable assets, the stronger your position will be. But in talking to my TEO colleagues, the idea of a rent or an interest rate that ratchets up once the national emergency is over, that seems like a reasonable thing for an exempt organization to do in light of all the circumstances. So there are no perfect answers here. And I think anytime you're making this type of loan, you're going to want to review the specific facts and circumstances really carefully and make sure that you're tailoring it in a manner that you have an exit strategy for when the blanket is no longer available. So off back to Darby.
So we have some really fascinating developments happening throughout the landscape of the regulatory world we all live in with respect to surge capacity for dealing with the anticipated needs of COVID-19 patients. And CMS, I think, has been, again, should be commended for being creative and flexible and understanding that we need alternative care sites as an option. And you see that come through also in the Stark blanket waivers. So there is a specific waiver available for physician-owned hospitals that are typically limited to their bed count and room count under provisions of the Affordable Care Act that went into effect in 2010. The blanket waiver allows those physician-owned hospitals to temporarily expand the number of rooms and beds in order to help with surge capacity, as well as a physician owners of ASCs that temporarily convert to hospitals through a separate streamlined enrollment and certification process that CMS is setting up, also may still refer to that ASC that's now a hospital if the conversion is consistent with the state's emergency preparedness or pandemic plan. Also keep in mind that, again, CMS and its wisdom here being extremely flexible also has a process for freestanding EDs to enroll as ASCs right now and then convert to hospitals. So we've got several different paths here where physician-owned entities that typically would be subject to rather strict rules and the exceptions around their referrals to those entities they own, now having flexibility to help with surge capacity. One very, very important note here, though, of course, as we've said many times, this relief is only temporary. After the crisis is over, the waiver ends. And obviously, we're talking about operationalizing very big things here with respect to converting the use of facilities as well as expanding the number of beds. So certainly, if you are operating in this world, thinking ahead and planning for what to do when the waivers end, we'll put you in a much better position at the end of this chaos.
So building on the desire to provide more flexibility on site of service, the Stark Law waivers also include flexibility for the group practice location requirement. So this is part of the in-office ancillary services exception, which many of you may be familiar with. So in order to use that exception, you may recall that the services have to be provided in a particular location. So they're defined under the exception as either the same building or a centralized building that is owned by the group practice or used by the group practice. But CMS is recognizing that there may need to be other sites of service where certain services are provided. For example, a mobile van situation or a trailer. So CMS is allowing flexibility in using the in-office ancillary exception for services that are provided in some of these alternative locations that don't qualify as the group practices same building or centralized building. Similarly, CMS has allowed services to be provided in a patient's home or an assisted living facility or an independent living facility, as long as the referring physician's principal medical practice doesn't consist of treating patients in the home. So an example of that would be a physician ordering a radiology service for a self-isolating Medicare beneficiary, which is something that typically wouldn't have been protected by the in-office ancillary services exception. So, you know, again, you know, very positive developments and CMS's recognition of the creativity that needs to happen right now and where care is being provided.
So moving on to compensation to physicians, and it's typically, these are the non-monetary compensations, medical staff incidental benefits exception, and the non-monetary compensation exception. The gist of the waivers is that the cap on the amount that can be of the item or service or the annual cap have been waived. Medical staff incidental benefits are no longer, or during the period of the COVID crisis, aren't limited to $36 per item or service. And the $423 annual per physician limit is waived under the non-monetary compensation exception. What this allows is for DHS entities, specifically hospitals, to provide members of the medical staff or other, you know, childcare, change of clothes, isolation, accommodation, temporary housing, that sort of thing. The support personnel could be sent to physicians' offices to assist with COVID-19 staffing under the non-monetary comp exception as well. So just a significantly more flexibility, it seems to me, in how hospitals can approach providing benefits to their medical staff to accommodate their needs, the, you know, practical, personal, and comfort needs when they're on the front lines. So I'll turn it back to Darby.
No, I think, Bob, it's Renee.
Oh, sorry, I jumped.
Just got to go back, no problem. So I'm just going to mention a few of the writing requirements. I think we've covered this to some extent, so I won't dwell on this too much. But one really helpful aspect of the blanket waivers is that CMS is allowing arrangements to commence prior to satisfying the writing and signature requirements, as long as you satisfy all of the other applicable requirements of the exception. So a good example of that would be a purchase agreement is entered, you know, for a organization to purchase PPE from a physician group. And that purchase could happen and before an actual written contract is executed. And obviously that allows for, that for quicker transactions and flexibility in a way that didn't exist before when everyone had to dot all their I's and cross their T's in order to comply with STARC. So I think that should be helpful in allowing organizations to be nimble in entering into some of these arrangements. Another example is physicians starting to provide call coverage at, a below or above fair market value, probably above fair market value rate, prior to actually signing the agreement for those services. Just to reiterate, I think some points that Darby and Bob have already made, very important that we're documenting the COVID-19 purposes because CMS requires that upon request, an entity make available documentation supporting the use of the blanket waivers. There's no specific documentation that's required. And there's no requirement to give advance notice to the secretary of an intention to enter into one of these arrangements. But again, very important to document the COVID-19 purpose, not only in the event that the secretary ever asked for that information, but also for internal tracking purposes and to ensure that these arrangements are reviewed at the end of the waiver period. Now turning it back over
Renee,
to Bob.
Mm-hmm. Renee, I've got one comment there on the writing requirement. Just to remind everyone, luckily we are not living in, you know, the old Stark world where CMS was really looking for a formal document that looked like a contract. We have the ability now, within reason and within the guidance, to cobble together documentation, contemporaneous documentation that evidences the writing. And so I just want to circle back on the tip we shared earlier about designating a point person if possible. Another side benefit to that approach is that that person can then keep track of the folks in the organization who are out there actually having these conversations with physicians, so that in the event that we need to, you know, collect those documents that evidence the writing at a future point, there can be an organized system of tracking who talked to Dr. Smith about, you know, his hold harmless, and let's pull his emails and let's see if we have everything there from a writing requirement perspective, if for some reason, you know, a formal amendment fell through the cracks. So just another nod there, a recommendation to the extent possible to have an organized way of approaching these arrangements from the outset to help with all of the myriad of, you know, complex Stark requirements that are still in play.
Great. Thanks, Darby. Very helpful.
Very good. Yeah, I would just chime in that the fact that the writing requirements are waived doesn't mean that it's a good idea not to put it in writing. I think, you know, both Renee and Darby have highlighted the reasons why documentation is still important. It's nice to have the flexibility, but under the best of all worlds, you wouldn't have a document in place. So that brings us to the point in this presentation about what Stark issues are not waived under the blanket waivers. First of all, the blanket waivers are limited to direct financial relationships. Indirect arrangements are not included and subject to the indirect analysis. And Darby is going to go into that in a little bit more detail with some examples. Also noteworthy is that the set in advance requirement of the where applicable to an exception is still in place. Commercial reasonableness is still a requirement, although one would think it would be modified by the circumstances of the COVID-19 crisis. The prohibition on volume or value of referrals or other business generated is still in place. If you're relying on the exception, there's only elements of the exception that have been waived under the blanket waivers, and volume of value is not one of them. Per-click compensation arrangements for rental arrangements, if you're renting an MRI or whatever, still can't do it on a per-click basis. And finally, the blanket waivers don't address physician recruitment arrangements. Those remain intact, and really there's no blanket waiver for modifying those should you want to. So just pausing for a moment and thinking about some of the practical implications of what the portions of Stark that are still in play, the set in advance requirement is an element under the personal services arrangement exception or fair market value arrangement exception. And that set in advance requirement isn't waived. So can a hospital amend a services contract to pay physicians more for call coverage during the COVID-19 crisis if the compensation terms in the existing agreement haven't been in place for a year? Well, I think the answer is yes, but this is something that you're gonna need to spend a little bit of time understanding the nature of the contract, what's happening here, and whether or not, is it appropriate to suspend or terminate the existing contract because circumstances have changed so dramatically. I think that is an option. It may be a relatively safe option. And then you enter into a new arrangement that is only for the period of the crisis with the adjusted compensation. Secondly, another alternative that may well work would be to amend the agreement prospectively, citing the change in circumstances as the justification for changing the rate. And I think providing call coverage services during a COVID-19, like working in the ICU or working in the, you know, ED or whatever, that's different than working in the ICU or working in the ED during normal time period where we weren't facing this pandemic. So I think there are ways you can do it, but it will be a fact-specific analysis. Another example, hospital uses volume-based criteria to determine which physicians it will provide financial accommodations. The agreements in that instance may not fit within the waivers because you're making the accommodation based upon the volume of the physician's referrals. I don't really know how all of this is going to play out, but I think you need to think about what kind of criteria you are using for determining who is going to benefit from your largesse and who will not. And having, we'll talk more about how you might set those criteria, but doing it based on volume or value could be problematic. Note here, if you do that, there will also likely be anti-kickback risks in the mix. So with that, I'm going to move back to Renee, I think, for some examples of the waivers.
Thanks, Bob. We've already given a number of examples and going through some of the specific Stark Law waivers that are, you know, in the CMS document, but I just wanted to point out a few that we haven't gone through yet, which may be of interest just to illustrate, you know, how these work in real life. So CMS provided, I think, 20 different examples in its document. One that we came up with that I think will be pretty common is, you know, a hospital agreeing to pay some employed physicians based on historical production because of the cancellation of elective procedures. And one of the questions that we've received so far in this presentation was actually that exact issue. Would it be okay under the employment and personal services waiver to permit 100% guarantee for someone who had a significant drop in productivity based on production during a historical period? You know, the question is, are there limits to that? I think the waiver as written would allow for it, but the practical issues are gonna be, well, okay, we do that for one physician, but can we actually do that for everyone who's paid based on production? Probably not. So the more difficult question is, how do we decide which physicians are going to get the benefit of being paid based on historical volumes, which obviously don't remotely track current volumes. So there's some tough decisions that need to be made. And, you know, from the organization's perspective, you know, consider that, you know, the physicians have a contract which entitles them to a particular payment rate. And it's just because there are waivers, you know, the employer is not obligated to use those waivers and to enter into new agreements. So there'll have to be, you know, some discernment about the circumstances under which, you know, those types of alternative compensation arrangements should be accommodated. One thing to consider, you know, if a hospital is going to agree to pay based on historical production, contrary to the requirements of the contract, should the hospital ask for something in return? If this is someone who's not doing any procedures right now and is basically idle, should that as a trade-off to receiving historical production compensation, should that physician be asked to do something in response to the COVID-19 emergency, you know, some sort of call or you know, ER coverage or providing surgical services in his or her specialty area. You know, there's certainly things that can be done to give the organization something of value in exchange for what they're providing by way of compensation benefit to the physician. Another example of how the waivers could be used would be sending personnel to community physicians' offices, for example, to assist with COVID-19 screening. Providing staffing to a referring physician might ordinarily be considered a no-no, but in this circumstance, obviously, there's a huge public benefit, and you know that would be an appropriate use of a Stark Law waiver. Providing kind of non-monetary compensation to emergency physicians.
such as, you know, temporary lodging, childcare, meals for physicians who don't want to return to their families after their shifts. So there's a very practical example of ways in which we might want to compensate physicians in a way that would technically not be okay under Stark, given the value of some of these items and services that, you know, obviously would be welcome, you know, during the current crisis. So I'm going to turn it back to Darby, who will talk about some examples of when we cannot use the waivers.
Sure. So as Bob previewed, indirect arrangements are not covered by the blanket waivers. We've had a lot of internal discussion about the practical consequences of that limitation. I would remind everyone to always keep in mind the definition of indirect compensation arrangement under Stark is quite complex, but one element is that the physician must receive aggregate compensation that varies with the volume or value of referrals or other business generated. And the fact that the fact of the matter tends to be that many indirect relationships, when you draw boxes and lines on paper, are not actually indirect relationships under that definition. So the exclusion here of indirect arrangements may not have huge practical implications, although, you know, certainly scrutinize arrangements, particularly those with ACOs, clinically integrated networks, and foundation model physician practices in California, as well as other corporate practices of medicine states like Texas. Bob already mentioned that the set in advance requirement, volume or value standards are still in effect. The other glaring omission here from CMS is that they have not changed the commercial reasonableness standards or waived them in any of these blanket waivers expressly, but, you know, our thinking is that the consideration of COVID-19 purposes is likely relevant to the determination of whether a particular arrangement is commercially reasonable. So again, practically, it might not have huge disastrous effects that CMS didn't actually expressly waive commercial reasonableness. And then, of course, if you go through this analysis and decide that the blanket waivers just don't suit your needs for one reason or another, DHS entities can still apply for individual 1135 waivers for those unique situations. CMS has directed folks to send their requests to the call center email address that they typically use for answering questions, noted specifically to include the words request for 1877G waiver so that they will turn their attention to it more quickly. The requirement is, or the suggestion from CMS is, to outline the specific scenario that doesn't meet the exception. And our tip is, be really explicit. Include in your request to CMS the COVID-19 purpose that this arrangement will be fulfilling, because they likely are still going to be issuing waivers on the basis of the fact that they meet one of those COVID-19 purposes. The responses are expected to take up to a week, but CMS is aiming for quicker turnarounds whenever possible. And they have said that if they grant these individual waivers, they should be retroactive to March 1. We don't know the duration of individual waivers. It would be reasonable to expect CMS to allow them to continue during the period of the public health emergency, much like the blanket waivers, but certainly pay attention when CMS gets back to you and make sure that that is the case. And back to Bob.
So, thank you. Looking beyond the Stark law, because the blanket waivers are very specific, they waive Stark, which, you know, in oftentimes when I'm analyzing a financial relationship, that's sort of my threshold question. But if you're within the waiver, you're comfortable, what else do you need to worry about? Well, I would lead with the federal anti-kickback statute. But as Renee mentioned earlier, on April 3rd, the OIG issued a policy statement indicating that it wouldn't impose administrative sanctions for 11 out of the 18. It's essentially the compensation-based blanket waivers, that those would not be subject to enforcement by administrative enforcement under the anti-kickback statute by the Office of the Inspector General. Again, I have to compliment the government here for anticipating this issue and for taking act, for being proactive, and for OIG and CMS to coordinate in this way is something that I think should be applauded and recognized for their efforts. Moving on to the tax exempt issues, those have not been waived. You will need to deal with private inurement if you've got insiders involved, like a physician who serves on the hospital board. The private benefit analysis would apply to non-insiders. And then, excuse me, also consider tax-exempt bond financing might impose some restrictions depending upon the specific arrangement you're looking at. State law restrictions are obviously not addressed by the CMS waivers, and Renee is going to talk about those in just a minute, but state kickback, state Stark, and so forth. Finally, governmental entities may face prohibitions on the gift of public funds. So the fact that you may be able to pay somebody above or below fair market value under the Stark waiver may not address your limitations on gift of public funds. So with that, I'm going to turn it to Renee for state law issues.
Thanks, Bob. I'll move quickly here because I want to make sure we allow enough time for questions. Just perhaps stating the obvious, the CMS waiver is only a waiver of the Stark law and obviously doesn't waive any state mini Stark laws or other state level fraud and abuse laws. So just be aware of those. If you happen to be in a state where there's active enforcement of your state fraud and abuse laws, consider whether they might still apply to the arrangement and whether there's regulatory risk if there isn't any corresponding state law waiver. I know that many state hospital associations have been engaged in efforts to try to obtain state law waivers that harmonize with some of the federal waivers. So we could be, there could be new developments on that front, but just keep in mind that your state fraud abuse laws and as well as your state facility and practitioner licensing requirements likely continue to apply, so make sure those are not overlooked. Turning it back to Darby for some collateral considerations.
And as if you all didn't have enough to think about already with the Stark Law, of course, we have a myriad of other authorities taking action at the state and local level through executive orders, moratoria, local emergency measures, all of which could have an impact on certainly the existence of a COVID-19 purpose, but also just in general, whether any of the actions you're taking with respect to physician arrangements actually require any protection under the blanket law waiver. So for example, if the governor issues an executive order requiring rent abatement during the COVID-19 emergency, you know, you may consider whether a formal lease amendment is actually necessary to meet the requirements of the blanket waiver or how the waivers might actually come into play with a situation like that. So just wanted to flag here the complexity of other activities taking place at the state and local level through executive orders that may also impact the Stark analysis. Bob.
So late at night and you've got too many blankets on, you start to sweat, it's not comfortable. This is the problem with CMS having created significant flexibility for DHS entities under the blanket waivers. Breadth of the waivers, I think, is both a blessing and a curse. Financial considerations will likely prevent most DHS entities from offering all of the financial assistance that that will be requested. I think physicians may start lining up, pointing to the waivers as justification for all sorts of different accommodations. So you've got a host of requests before you, and most organizations are going to have to go through some level of discernment in deciding which request to accommodate and which to deny. On this front, I think it would be you know, it's hard to stay ahead of the game in the context of this crisis, but adopting consistent, defensible decision-making criteria as to what accommodations you will fund and those that you, you know, although you could, you will defer or you will condition. I'd suggest avoiding considerations relating to volume of value of physician referrals for reasons that we've already discussed. But think about what's important to your organization, what's important to providing help in your community, and, you know, focus your waiver, your decision as to which waiver request to fund around those issues. And I wanted to ask Darby and Renee to weigh in here with thoughts they may have about how organizations faced with these problems might navigate it.
So this is Renee. I want to go back to a point that Darby made, which I think was really a good one, is if you can, to appoint someone who is kind of spearheading the efforts to create these waivered arrangements and also to discern, which one should be entered into. And, you know, I'm guessing it's going to need to be a number of individuals involved in those types of decisions. And you may not always have the luxury of a lot of time to think about, you know, which requests we're going to grant and which ones we're not. You know, it could be that the first people to, you know, ask for help, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, you know, they're going to be the ones that get the first arrangements, but then, you know, does that open the floodgates to, you know, needing to grant, you know, similar requests? So I think having a coordinated effort as much as practical would really help, you know, make sure that you're providing or you're applying consistent criteria to these requests so you don't wind up in a situation where you provide rent abatement to, you know, a group of neurosurgeons, for example, where there may not be the same financial hardship issues as, say, a primary care group. So, you know, just thinking about, you know, rational considerations you might use in advance to the extent that you have the luxury of time and you may not. But anything you can do in advance to come up with some criteria that are at least somewhat objective, I think would be helpful.
Yeah, I agree, Renee. And I also think that you hit on a really important one, which is the financial distress aspect of this. I don't want to seem unrealistic and think that, you know, folks have the time or ability to go out and ask for disclosures around the hardship that each practice who needs support is facing. But I do think that, you know, it's a question that needs to be asked and certainly something that is absolutely reasonable to consider when deciding which groups get support. You know, what level of financial distress are they in, as well as Bob's point about community needs. You know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of these decisions can be second guessed, but if you are able to demonstrate that, you know, you only had one group of general surgeons in your service area, and if they went under and they had to move and couldn't cover your level two trauma, you know, designation, you and your community would be in a really hard place. That's a good factor. So just, I think, being rational about it and uniform to the extent you can, but also coming back to a place of who actually needs the financial support is always a good idea.
Very good. I'm now going to turn it over to Jillian to talk about employment law considerations.
Great. Thanks, Bob. So, and I'm going to move pretty quickly here. We only have a few minutes left. And really, all of these employment law considerations are really heavily dependent on the facts. And so I do encourage folks to reach out to counsel or advisors to kind of help you navigate if you are going to be making changes to the terms of employment or compensation structure for folks, that you get some help with that. And, you know, because as I mentioned, the waiver does not waive any existing contractual obligations or many of the employment-related legal obligations you may have to folks. So, and just a word about folks that you may be employing who are not covered by a contract. You know, you can change the terms and compensation for those folks pretty easily, so long as it's on a prospective basis and really would just require you to provide them notice that, you know, things have changed and now you're going to be paid this much, and then that, documenting that and then having them accept that just by continuing to perform their job is enough for those folks who aren't covered by contract. But if you've got people who are subject to a contract, you need to look at that contract, because this does not waive those obligations. So we need to think about how to go about amending the contract, renegotiating it, or terminating it altogether and entering it into something new. So how do we sort of, things to keep on your radar as you look at that process, pull out those contracts and actually read them through. It's probably been a while, always a good good idea to look at those terms. You're going to want to focus in on, there may be a provision that's specific to amendments, how this contract can be amended, how it can be terminated. Look at those provisions. You likely have some notification obligations. There may be a provision that says, you know, you need to give 120 days notice before you try to amend the contract. Look at the specific time commitments, or perhaps the contract has a provision that requires a provider to look at a specific location, work at a specific location, or work a specific number of hours a week. That's probably not possible right now. Maybe a location has been closed, or maybe it's just simply there's not enough work to do 40 hours a week. So look at those provisions to see sort of what you've asked the provider to promise you and what you've promised that you would provide the provider. Productivity pay, changes in funding. I've seen some contracts that have said, hey, you know, if there's been a change in our funding, that may open up some opportunity to amend this contract. And then any force majeure clauses, which aren't super common in these types of contracts, but you may have something like that there. If you don't have anything in the actual contract, and by the way, hopefully you've got some providers who are willing to come to the table and work with you to amend that contract. No matter what the contract says, if for the most part, if the two parties to that contract want to make some changes and they agree to do that, that can be done rather easily. I mean, you want to document, are we changing the entire contract? Are we retaining certain provisions? Be really clear about what may still survive within the existing contract and what we're changing. Are we throwing the whole thing out the window? You'd want to look at making sure the term is clear. When does this expire? But if you've got somebody who's willing to work with you, then that's going to make your job a lot easier to take advantage of some of these compensation changes. But if you don't, you have some other strategies that you still need to make some changes. What can you do? You've looked at those provisions in the contract to just see if there's anything specific that might apply here. But if not, you can do some sort of general contract strategies like frustration of purpose. Certain obligations can be excused where the purpose of the contract has been undermined. That could come into play here. Or impossibility. It's simply not possible to provide this position, let's say, with this much work, or to work at this particular location. It's just not possible. Some of these strategies can be used to require that provider to work with you to amend that contract. And then beyond the contract, don't forget about some of your other obligations as an employer. So you've got paid time off requirements, potentially depending on where your folks are operating. You may have a legal obligation to continue providing them with certain types of paid time off. This waiver does not excuse you from doing that. You still have some obligations to provide a safe work site. I'm thinking about maybe you're now having a provider work in a totally different environment. You got to make sure they've got what they need, that they're trained, and that they, you know, feel safe in that environment. And so you got to keep thinking about your OSHA requirements there. Discrimination and retaliation concerns, you know, particularly if you're changing compensation, you do want to try to have some objective criteria so that you aren't just changing all of the contracts for folks, let's say, under the age of 40, or what if you have a female provider who says, hey, you know, you gave this male provider these great terms and I'm not getting those. Those types of discrimination claims can still be brought during this time. So you really want to make sure that you're thinking through and documenting the reasons why you may be entering into new arrangements with folks, so that someone isn't going to get the you know, isn't going to perceive that it's based on something discriminatory. So for folks who have unionized populations of employees, you may still have some obligations to the union, so you want to keep that in mind. And as employment lawyers always say, document, document, document. Make sure you're documenting your rationale behind these decisions, even if it's internal emails with each other about sort of who we're going to approach, how we're thinking this through, and then making sure that you're documenting that with your employees and providers so that everybody's on the same page, so that down the road, if we need to defend these decisions, we'll be in a good place to do that. So with that, I think it's time for some questions. So I'm going to turn it back over to Bob to kind of walk us through some of these questions that have been coming in.
Sure. One of the questions that I guess I'll jump in on first was, okay, CMS has issued this blanket waiver saying it's not going to enforce Stark arrangements that would otherwise violate the Stark law. This is being done pursuant to the 1135 waiver. It's not formal rulemaking. Does that waiver address the False Claims Act or potential False Claims Act exposure? And I think the answer is yes, it should. And if no other way, I think it's because CMS has said it will pay for services that are provided pursuant to arrangements that fit within the exception or fit within the blanket waiver. That means that the government does not consider strict compliance with the regulatory exceptions and that it have been created as material. So under an Escobar materiality analysis, I think that False Claims Act case is based upon a distinction between what the regulatory requirements are and what the waiver requirements are for a particular arrangement shouldn't be viable. And Renee, do you see that differently?
No, I agree, Bob. I think the thing to point out here is that the Stark Law is strict liability. So obviously there's a huge need for a waiver if there's not going to be strict compliance with Stark. Whereas the Department of Justice is enforcing laws that have some element of intent. So in the False Claims Act context, you know, there's no liability unless you you knew or recklessly disregarded the truth of something. So, you know, that's always an element. And then, of course, if the underlying conduct is legal because it was entered into as part of a waiver, you know, there would be no underlying legal violation that could be the subject of a False Claims Act case. You know, I don't think this means that, you know, we're going to expect waivers of prosecution from the government, but I think we can certainly expect them to use their discretion to, you know, not consider arrangements that are otherwise valid because they're entered into under these waivers.
Great. Darby, did you want to take a question?
Sure. I think we addressed the first one early on in the presentation with respect to thoughts on selection criteria and related questions, understanding that, you know, you don't want to open up Pandora's box by reducing rental rates for one position tenant with respect to all the others, as well as how do you determine how to give out the goods for loans and the like. And I think we've given some good tips here about, you know, making sure that there are defensible purposes behind that that aren't related to volume or value, documented, well thought through based on financial hardship and the like. There's no perfect formula. We wish that CMS had had the time to go through formal rulemaking and we could have more insights on what they were looking for here. But in the absence, you know, taking a reasonable look at things and following some of the guidance we've already given is kind of the best folks can do. Do you all want to weigh in on those on that question again?
I think the criteria are difficult. I do think you could do something, for example, of say establish a per physician kind of rebuttable presumption that you're not going to provide any greater financial assistance to any individual physician in excess of X or in excess of some percentage of his or her normal compensation or historical compensation. The more objective you can get, you could, you know, more highly value or give priority to the types of subspecialties or physicians that are working on the front lines. That would be, maybe relatively easy. You're talking about your emergency room physicians, people working in ICU and that sort of thing. But the problem with stating that as a priority is you will face those, we're going to lose this service. We're going to lose our GI docs in this community if we don't do something to help them through this rough patch. And we need those people, and therefore we'll, have to make that accommodation. You're not going to be able, I agree with, Darby, you were talking about the this idea of financial due diligence. I don't think that's practical in this context to say, okay, physician group, you say you need help. Here's our application that looks like a mortgage application and, show me all your financials. I think you would be setting yourself up for failure if you adopted that sort of process. Renee, did you want to add anything, or we're closing in on?
I think we're over time. Yeah, so yeah. I don't want to pile on.
So
I haven't seen any other questions come in. So it, certainly, if folks have additional questions, they're welcome to contact us offline. You should have our email addresses. We're happy to follow up with you individually on any questions that you might have.
With that, I'm going to turn it back to PJ to wrap things up.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you all for attending and have a great day.